You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Tang Li. I'm a director and a senior fellow at the John L. Saunton China Center here at Brookings. First, I want to thank you all for braving the cold to attend today's conference. This is the China Center's first event in the new year. So Happy New Year. And what an auspicious beginning in the year as we launch the publication of the second English volume of Zhu Rongji on the record. The second volume explores Premier Zhu Rongji's experiences as a very respected economic technocrat assisting Deng Xiaoping from 1998 to 2003. While countless factors have contributed to China's dramatic economic transformation, the groundbreaking economic reform instituted by Zhu Rongji in these 5 years were critical in setting the stage for China to emerge as an economic powerhouse. It is also interesting to note that the current leadership's bold reform agenda, whether it be very strong anti-corruption campaign, the crackdown on inefficient SOEs, financial liberalization, or greater economic integration with the world economy, can all be traced back to Premier Zhu Rongji's remarkable effort in these years. This raises a very important question. What lessons can China's current leaders learn from reforms over a quarter of a century ago? Now, when we launched the first volume of Zhu Rongji's selected works, we held an event in New York City that was largely celebratory. Today is an equally exciting day. With the launch of the second volume, we decided to take a more academic and also more analytical approach to explore China's push for reform, both in Zhu's time and now. We'll begin with a panel on the Zhu Rongji era, featuring some U.S. policymakers who work with Zhu Rongji and others who analyze him. And then we will move on to a panel discussing progress on China's economic reform efforts that were announced at the largely from the third platinum and still continuing speeding manner in since the 2013 and now has been 2 years, almost 1.5 years. And finally, we will have a panel addressing the state of U.S.-China trade and investment. Today's event wouldn't be possible without our friends at the Beijing Foreign Press. I hope that they will look at our website, and also the Brookings Press, who have embraced this project as a way to promote U.S.-China culture exchanges and inform English-speaking audiences about the lasting legacy of Premier Zhu Rongji. Now, we are particularly pleased to be hosting so many prominent friends from Peking University. And, even one scholar all the way from Canada. And so it's really quite remarkable that, we have this wonderful group of people from China travel all the way. And I would like to thank the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations for sponsoring the travel of these Chinese panelists here today. Last but not least, I want to extend thanks to my distinguished colleagues at the China Center, Ken Libersaw, David Arnold, and Jeffrey Beda, for their help in organizing today's event and for bringing together such a wonderful group of really internationally well-known scholars. And now I invite to the stage the members of our first panel, moderated by my mentor, the founding director of our China Center, and also a former U.S. negotiator who has much contacts with Premier Zhu Rongji, Dr. Jeff Bader. Welcome.
ends when I'm in the middle.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see so many people here on this cold and grim morning.
I think it's, if you can't hear me, just wave in the back. I think the mic is on. So, Chung Lee already used the M word, mentor, in describing me for some reason, but I appreciate that, Chung Lee. But it's quite daunting for me to be on the panel here with two people who truly are mentors to me, and the third who I wish had been a mentor to me. Nick Lardy taught me whatever I know about Chinese economics, and Ken Liebethal has taught me whatever I know about the Chinese system and the linkage between the political and economic systems. And I just wish I had the opportunity to study with Justin down through the years. This first panel the way the day is structured, there's going to be a panel that's going to deal mostly with history, a panel that's going to deal mostly with what's going on now, and a panel that's going to deal with what's coming in the future. This panel will deal mostly with history and with what happened from 1998 to 2003. I will be clear, I'm not going to cut anyone off if they decide to talk about the present or if they make linkages between what happened then and what's going on in the present, because I think that's very, very much a reality and something we all need to think about. So feel free to range far and wide. I think Nick, I'm not going to try to shape what our folks are going to talk about. I think Nick will talk, maybe Nick will go first and talk about, focus largely on state-owned enterprise reform. Justin will concentrate on financial sector reform, and Ken, who was in the administration with me at the time, the U.S. administration, that is, will talk about the trade and investment issues that he had to deal with at the NSC at the time. But let's just go down the line, start with Nick.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and thanks to Brookings for organizing this. I think it's a very worthwhile project to bring all of this material to an English-speaking audience. I just wanted to begin on a personal note and say I first met Zhu Rongji in Hawaii in 1987, the very end of the year at a conference. We had breakfast together several mornings, and on the third morning he told me the previous evening he'd gotten a phone call and that he was going to become the mayor of Shanghai. And then I interacted with him quite a few times over the years, and certainly one of the more memorable occasions was when President Clinton hosted the state dinner for Zhu Rongji and I got invited. Ken has never explained to me exactly, but I suspect he snuck into the office of the chief of protocol and surreptitiously inserted my name on the invitation list, so that was another opportunity to interact with him. I think SOE reform certainly is one of the major legacies of Zhu Rongji, many legacies in many, many different domains. But in the enterprise reform, which he launched, I think was crucial, as Chung Lee said, to setting the foundation for China's rapid growth in the 2000s. And certainly you can look at the standard metrics. The number of state firms declined dramatically. The number of people employed in state enterprises, both in the service sector and particularly in manufacturing, shrank dramatically. Employment went down by about 25% in the Zhu Rongji period. The number of industrial firms declined by half as firms were privatized or closed down. And this set the stage for a substantial resurgence in the state sector. There were many, many money-losing state firms in the mid-90s when Zhu launched this program. The losses of these firms were quite substantial, about 1.5% of GDP. By the time he left office, they were down to about 0.5% of GDP. So it was roughly a two-thirds decline in the drag that these state-owned industrial enterprises were imposing on the economy. this, I think, set the stage for some of the things that Justin might talk about on the financial side. It set the stage for eliminating the so-called policy lending, in which the central bank gave money to individual banks with the condition that it be unlent to certain state-owned enterprises. This was sometimes called policy lending, 政策贷款, or the other term that was frequently applied to it was relending, the 再贷款, because this central bank gave the money to the banks, which in turn had to give it to certain state-owned enterprises, in many cases, to cover their operating losses. So I think these reforms were very, very far-reaching, and in addition to cutting the losses, we saw a very substantial improvement in the return on assets of state-owned companies in the industrial sector. They had had terrible returns in the mid-90s, and they began to rise in 1998 and then rose steadily for quite a few years based on the reforms that were undertaken. So capital was used more efficiently, productivity went up, losses were cut, and I think the economy is also very successful in absorbing the number of people that lost employment in state-owned enterprises. There was a very concerted effort on re-employment and support for people that lost their jobs that meant that this massive transformation occurred in a fairly smooth manner from a political point of view. So I would certainly put SOE reform, you know, at or near the top of the list in terms of the legacy of Zhu when he was premier.
So me? Well, it's quite a pleasure for me to participate in this panel, and because I was considered one of the brand trust of Zhu Rongji, so it's quite an honor for me to talk about his legacy in the Chinese economic reform and transition. And one of the most challenging jobs for a planned economy to move to a market economy is the financial sector reform. As you know, that in a planned economy, actually, there was no commercial financial sector at all, because in a planning economy, everything was allocated through administrative measures. And so even we have the banks, but bank actually is just a branch of Ministry of Finance. And so in the transition period, China started to build the banking sectors. But at the beginning, as Nick just mentioned, there was no separation between policy lending and commercial lending. And when Zhu came to the central government in 1991, one of his first contributions was to set up three policy banks, the China Development Bank, Exim Bank, Agricultural Development Bank. And so to separate the commercial function with the policy function. That was one of the main contributions. And in the period that we are focusing today, from 1998 to 2003, when he was the prime minister, I think one of the main contributions was to deal with the non-performing loan issues. Because in 1998, China certainly was affected by the East Asian financial crisis. And the growth rate in China dropped from, you know, more than 10% down to around 7 to 8%. And with that kind of changes, you can imagine an economy having to rely on bank lending to, you know, support investment and so on. And so the non-performing loan accumulate quickly. And according to Nick, the non-performing loan in the four major state banks reached as much as about 47% or 48%. Also, officially, China acknowledged the non-performing loan was about 25%. And with these kind of challenges, under the leadership of Zhu Rongji, he set up four asset management companies and took over those kind of non-performing loans, reduced the non-performing loan ratio, prepared those four banks to be listed in Hong Kong Stock Market Exchange. And so in order to improve the governance of the banking sectors. And we know that a powerful country must have powerful financial sectors. And because of this reform, now those four banks are all among the top 10 banks in the world. So I think that's one of the very important contributions. But in addition to dealing with the non-performing loans of those four state banks, actually he also made a contribution to consolidate in the late 1990s about 4,000 small local financial institutions. At that time, they encountered similar situation of high non-performing ratios. Some were even more serious than those four state banks. And he consolidated those around 4,000 financial institutions into 115 city banks, local city banks. And that also helped to stabilize the financial structure, financial sector in China. And I think that his contribution paved the way. After 2003, China continued to have about 10 years of very dynamic growth and become, and now the non-performing loan in those financial sectors reduced down to about 2%, 3% at the most. So I think that is one of the major contributions. As I mentioned, that without a strong financial sectors, it's hard to have a strong economy. And because it's a reform, that made it possible. But certainly, for a country to have a sustainable growth, we need to further improve our financial structure, our financial sectors. But anyway, his contribution laid down the foundation, allowed China to have a further development in a much more healthy way. So let me stop here.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to have an opportunity to participate in this panel. I dealt with Premier Zhu primarily during the negotiation for the U.S.-China bilateral accession agreement that really created the conditions for China's entry into the WTO, in that everything that China negotiated with the U.S. Became the starting point for rounding out the bilateral accession agreement with all other countries. What you agreed to with any one country became part of your general accession agreement. And so all other countries basically felt that the U.S. should do 95% of it, and then some others would pick up particular items that they needed to move on to show that they had met some particular needs of their own constituencies. So this was a very wide-ranging agreement, and it was a very, very tough negotiation. I frankly read this book that just came out. I do want to note, as Cheng said, not only did we just publish this, but this event is in part to highlight that we just published this, and so we hope that you will have a chance to look at it. I read this book, which is overwhelmingly on the domestic side of what Premier Zhu did, with a kind of a question in my mind as to how much did the style that I encountered in dealing with him on the WTO accession carry over to his style domestically. And because his accomplishments domestically were enormous. I think of him largely as being the person, if you think of it, that, Deng Xiaoping marked the major transition away from the Maoist system and getting China on a long-term path of a much more successful type of development. But the policy problems built up over time so that by the late 90s, there needed to be some major changes. You couldn't keep incrementally doing what they were doing. You needed to actually make structural changes and go against a lot of interests in the way the system then functioned in order to clear the path for the next decade or two. And Zhu, very early on in this book, talking in an internal talk, made very clear that if they didn't make the changes that he was seeking, and seeking with Jiang Zemin, that China would be in deep, deep trouble in the first decade of the next century. And so in a sense, it resonates with where China is now. where they had enormous growth. One of the things that always startled me as I went through this book is every time Premier Zhu used a number, GDP, foreign exchange reserves, that kind of thing, you sit back and it makes you realize that China then was enormously poorer than it is now. That the growth from then to now has been extraordinary. Yet we're at a point with the Xi Jinping leadership where the assessment, which I think is correct, is that you need major changes, major structural reforms, in order to clear the way for the next several decades. So I was very curious to see how Premier Zhu came across in this. And frankly, he was very consistent, very smart, very, very tough. Used the experience that he got, mayor of Shanghai, which he refers to repeatedly, and then as vice premier, deeply involved in the banking system, to full effect as premier. Focused, though, on what he learned and how to get things done in China during that period. And some of the lessons are ones that we need to keep in mind now. Don't trust statistics. Then Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin asked Zhu about his confidence in the statistics that China was publishing on its national economy. And Zhu said, I can't tell you how accurate they are. The one thing I can assure you is that this year's statistics will be no less inaccurate than last year's. And it was not a bad rule to follow. Investigate lower levels, because local officials have their own incentives. And those incentives are not the same as those at the national level. So Zhu literally admonishes state council vice premiers and ministers in one of his earliest documents in this book that, let's face it, we know how to make good policies. We have smart people. We consult. We develop very good policies. The problem is they don't get implemented. And if you simply issue a document with a very clear policy and send it down, you'll be lucky if 20% of it is actually implemented at the local levels. You have to go down to the localities constantly to understand what they're dealing with. And so they understand what you need. And then you have to establish criteria of success, because if you don't have those criteria of success, frankly, we're not going to get there. Dealt constantly with the problem of corruption, which he at one point made the comment on the inspection tour. He said, I am always amazed at the level of corruption. Many officials are so corrupt, it is astonishing. And then the question is, how do you attack that problem effectively? His agendas included, obviously, SOE reform and financial reform and corruption, but more broadly also reducing the size of government, making the government clean and lean, two terms he used repeatedly, so that it was less of a burden and just, not too large to manage. Stop focusing on GDP growth as the major driver of success or major criterion of success. Have to pay attention to the environment and have to realize all the negative externalities of growth. Stop doing big projects as the key criterion for local officials of whether you're getting things done. Too many of the big projects are simply wasteful and end up losing money, which the local official doesn't care about, he comments, because the local official will have moved on by the time the cost has to be paid. And then finally, a very strong stress on the interdependence in terms of China's success or failure of dealing with the international arena, especially in the international economy, and domestic reform. And that's where I think with WTO, I'm sorry to take up all this on the domestic side rather than the WTO negotiation, but let me just conclude by saying that he saw joining WTO as absolutely crucial for providing the political leverage necessary to undertake the reforms domestically in China that he felt otherwise they could articulate, but they didn't have the political capital necessary to get them done to the extent necessary. And I think with that as a motivator, he then negotiating, he was key to the negotiations, an accession agreement for China that made, frankly, a startling array of commitments that I think he took very seriously as providing leverage for where China really needed to go. Let me stop there. Wait, can I add one anecdote that he does in the book? One other thing that he used to startling effect, he was A, often very sarcastic and very tough, but B, had a great sense of humor. And let me just highlight that with one exchange. This was in a meeting with Henry Kissinger. And I'll just capture part of the dialogue. This is verbatim. Premier Zhu, we are still not, this was in April of 2002. Premier Zhu, we are still not quite used to some of President Bush's ways. Kissinger, he comes from Texas in the central United States and thinks differently from New Yorkers. He needs to reconcile the Chinese style with the Texan style. The Chinese style is more indirect, while the Texan style is very direct. Zhu, so we should watch more Westerns. Kissinger, that would help. Oh, I'm sorry.
Was Zhu's last sentence?
Oh, so Zhu said we should watch more Westerns. And Kissinger responded, that would help.
I'd like to thank our panelists for getting us off to a great start. They each referred to their own experiences with Zhu Rongji, and I'm just a mere moderator, but they've inspired me to tell my own anecdote, if I may be permitted to use or abuse my position as moderator, just to give a sense of the way Zhu Rongji got things done. I remember, I think it was 1998, when we were stalled on the U.S.-China bilateral trade agreement. USTR in interagency meetings was basically saying that China does not have the political will to close this agreement. So I was at the NSC at the time, and I, Alan Greenspan was going to China, and by coincidence, Chairman Greenspan called me over to talk about his forthcoming trip. This is relevant to the book because the conversation that Chairman Greenspan had with Zhu Rongji is in the book. And it's one of the fascinating things about this book. You'll find conversations, verbatim conversations, kind of astonishingly candid and revealing conversations, which Zhu Rongji has decided to dump on the public in this book. And I remember this conversation very well. So I saw Chairman Greenspan and, you know, and his beat was not the bilateral trade agreement. But I said to him, we're stuck. Do you think you could help out? Do you have a view on this? And he said, well, this isn't really my beat, as you say, but I'm very much interested in seeing this come to a happy outcome, so I'll look for an opportunity to discuss this while I'm there. And I spoke to Ambassador Sasser and to his Deputy Chief of Mission in the run-up and said, you know, I hope there'll be an occasion to use the Greenspan visit, particularly the meeting with Zhu Rongji, to try to kickstart what's currently a dead negotiation. Next day, Greenspan saw Zhu Rongji, and I went to an interagency meeting, and the USTR representative began by saying, an astonishing thing happened yesterday in Beijing. Zhu Rongji, during a meeting with Chairman Greenspan, turned to the chargé d'affaires and said, Americans, I understand, think that we don't have the political will to complete this agreement. I am here to tell you that I do and we do. And let me illustrate that. And he then put on the table two or three significant, we'll call them concessions, I guess I could call them concessions now. Remember, one was in the area of insurance. I think one was in the area of agriculture. And Greenspan nodded, and our chargé nodded, and this was duly reported back to Washington to an astonished USTR, with whom, by the way, I had not coordinated. But anyway, that's what got the negotiation going. And it moved very rapidly to closure after that. The other thing I'd mention that I recall from that period in connection with this is the relationship between Zhu Rongji and Jiang Zemin was a complicated one, and that's something that maybe should be the subject of another panel. Zhu Rongji could do all kinds of things, but at the end of the day, Jiang Zemin was the general secretary of the Communist Party, and Zhu Rongji could not roll Jiang Zemin. He had to work through him, and had to work with him. And so, some of these efforts to get to closure, Zhu Rongji would be very forward-leaning, and then suddenly you would see him change his position. It wasn't because he had changed his position, it was because Jiang Zemin had said, don't go there. So anyway, those are just a few comments prompted by reading the book and hearing my colleagues talk about their own Zhu Rongji experiences. Let me just throw out a question or two to kick off discussion here. Anyone should feel free to jump in on these, but let me address questions to sort of one principal person and then others chime in. Nick, perhaps you could offer a view to us on, you know, we all know that Deng Xiaoping basically got the reforms rolling beginning in 1978 and then accelerated them again around 1992. In your view, what was left over? What did Deng not do that Zhu Rongji, what was so important about the 1998 to 2003 period that Deng had left unfinished for whatever reasons that Zhu moved?
Well, I think it's in the domains we've talked about. Certainly SOE reform was not very much, it was on the agenda earlier, but not very much was accomplished. There were lots of discussions about governance reforms and tweaking various aspects of the ministerial system that oversaw the very large number of state-owned companies, but there was no really coming to grips with the underlying problems, which is that a very large share of these companies were losing huge amounts of money and were very inefficient. And certainly that comes through over and over again in these speeches, and including when he's going to the local levels. You just can't borrow more money to keep things going. We have to make sure that the funds allocated through the banking system are used more efficiently. And you can't rely on, you know, indiscriminate expansion of credit to stimulate economic growth. So this goes to the whole thing that Justin was talking about. China didn't really have a very effective commercially oriented banking system at the time. So I think that, you know, that those things really came in the Zhu Rongji period. Nobody has mentioned, but it is worth noting that when he was vice premier, he was also simultaneously the governor of the central bank, I believe, starting in 93. So this is very unusual. I don't believe in the history of China's central bank that there has been a vice premier simultaneously serving as the governor of the central bank. So I think he gained an enormous amount of experience. Remember, this was a period of very, very high inflation at the time he came into the bank. Remember, consumer price inflation reached 25% in 1994. He brought that under control, and he was constantly, subsequently worried about the possibility of a resurgence of inflation, which he found, was one of his major challenges when he was governor of the central bank. So I think there was a lot, you know, Deng pushed things in the right direction, particularly in agriculture, but some of the core problems in the financial sector and the enterprise sector were, quite frankly, more or less papered over for quite a long time.
Well, now you see Zhu referring as premier in these papers constantly back to his problems in 1993-94, that there was the economy became overheated, inflation grew, debts piled up, too much money was put out there, so that was a searing experience for him, and it was one that he certainly wanted to caution everyone against policies that might get them into that position again. It kind of resonates in some ways, as I read it, with the policies during the global financial crisis and the huge credit expansion and rapid building, and now the need to deal with many of the consequences of that.
Justin, feel free to comment on that, Justin, yeah. But let me ask you a slightly different question. As you look at the third plenum, the current third plenum's agenda, financial sector, financial service sector reforms is very high in the list of priorities. And there's an awful lot that hasn't happened yet in financial sector reform in terms of interest rate liberalization, in terms of creation of a more substantial private banking sector that goes beyond the big banks, in terms of creating very liquid capital markets that that corporations and localities can use to raise funds. Moyev asking this is, what grade would you give to Jurong Ji and the financial service sector reform in 1998 to 2003? Do you think he did all that reasonably could have been done at the time, and that the challenge is now that this is just the way things are and that we're at a different stage of development and that the Ju could not take these things on? Was Ju as aggressive as he could have been and should have been on financial service sector reform? How would you evaluate?
Well, I certainly will give him an A for what he has done, because certainly there are many areas that require further reform now. But if you put the challenges that he had at that time, I think he did remarkably. Because, you know, in the transition to a market economy, China adopted a gradual dual-track approach and continue to provide some subsidies and protections to the old state-owned sectors. They are not viable because they were in capital-intensive advanced sectors. And China was still a poor country, as you mentioned, in the 1990s. Those kind of sectors, China did not have comparative advantage at all. And so without protection and subsidies, then they cannot survive. And then the whole economy can collapse. And under that kind of situation, because we know that before 1993, all the investment and operational cost of the state-owned sectors came from the fiscal appropriation. They didn't have any financial cost. But they still need to have some subsidies. And as a way to give those kind of state-owned sectors subsidies was to have some kind of financial repression. So interest rate need to be controlled, cannot really freely determined by the market exchange rate. But under the kind of condition, he, you know, trying a way to reform the financial sectors, on the one hand, reducing the non-performing loan, on the other hand, listing the banks on the stock market in order to improve the governance, and also, you know, invite strategic investors in the small banks to create a competition. And under that, I think he already achieved a lot. But certainly we require a certain kind of further reform because situation in China changes. China now is not a low-income, poor economy anymore. And many of those old sectors used to be against China's competitive advantages. Today, they are China's competitive advantages. Like in automobile sectors, the equipment machinery sectors. And so subsidies and so on are not necessary now. And so that allow in the third planner to introduce further marketization of the financial sectors. On the one hand, to liberalize the interest rate of lending and now also the interest rate of savings and to remove the financial, you know, repression. And he could not do that at that time. If he wanted to do that at that time, okay, he seemed to be very market-oriented, will be welcomed by many people outside China. But the result may be, you know, crisis or even a collapse in Chinese system. So with this kind, he is a very pragmatic person. He understands what should be the direction of the changes in China. But he also has a very good control, understanding about what are the limitations in China to do that. But anyway, he laid down the foundation for the reform, and at his time, he did the best, that good for China and good for the reform. So with that regard, I think I would give him an A+.
Thank you, Justin. He went from A to A+, in the course of that answer. Ken, I wonder if you might give us some thoughts on, you talked about juice of special and unique qualities in some ways, let's say an uncharacteristic Chinese leader in many ways. What kind of obstacles did he face in as premier in trying to move China in the direction that he wanted to go? What were the sort of objective? What were the objective factors and the kinds of resistance that he had to overcome, and how did he do it? In 30 seconds or 5 minutes.
Well, first of all, he had the advantage of being an A-plus person and having very good people in his brain trust. seriously, I think, first of all, he had a keen appreciation of China's realities. And so he didn't fool himself as to how big the problems were in particular areas and how much had to be changed. Secondly, he understood, it seems almost silly for for an outsider to say he understood, but it was obvious to me at least that he would run very far with the kinds of policies that he thought needed to be implemented. But he always went to Jiang Zemin for the political backing to make that work. And we saw this even in the WTO negotiations. Day by day, when we were in Beijing for the final set of negotiations, he would push hard, and then overnight he would talk with Jiang Zemin, and it would the tone would shift a bit. And in the book, again, he refers in several instances to how he developed something. And it was always, I had this idea, and then Jiang Zemin approved it and basically decided on the parameters, and now I can run with it. And so there was this interaction between the kind of political cover and then the person who knew the details and really went down and developed the very specific policies. And I think that was very, very effective. We saw in the WTO negotiations something else that was really very striking, which is that much of that negotiation, I'd be happy to be corrected, Justin, if you had a different view from the inside of this, a very strong sense from the outside was that a great deal of that negotiation and really crucial decisions in the final reaching the final bilateral accession agreement, those negotiations did not involve in a detailed way the affected interests in China. Some major decisions were made either on the spot in talking with the premier, or just he would come back a couple of hours later with an answer. And then when we got a final accession agreement, Jiang Zemin came out, met with the group to make clear that he blessed this 100%, right? And then afterwards, you got this being relayed in more detail down the pike to the ministries, et cetera, that were interested. My understanding is it had not been translated into Chinese. And let me say, even trying to read the English, for those who are not trade negotiators, I was there as the guy from the NSC, not as a professional trade person. Even in English, most of the time I couldn't understand what he was saying. So, negotiating this in English and then, and doing it without a Chinese text that the Chinese were negotiating internally, really quite startling. So I was really impressed with his ability to move forward, to be bold, but always to cover his political, or to assure that he had the political backing necessary at the very top of the party, and then focus on implementation once he got to where he needed to be in terms of top-level policy. He never left it there. He then really rammed it through the system.
Yeah, as feared as Zhu was through the bureaucracy, and he was the most feared man in China for that whole period, he was awfully careful with Jiang Zemin.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the Bill Clinton visit to Beijing in 98. And we knew the role that Drew was playing on WTO. So we wanted to give Drew a lot of face on the visit, I recall, and we'd scheduled some sort of an event with Jiang Zemin, and there was to be a joint press event with between Jiang and Clinton at the outset or the end of the meeting, and we scheduled a lunch with Zhu Rongji for Clinton, along with the whole State Council. And we told the Chinese we would have a joint press event at that event as well. Well, Zhu Rongji got back to us pretty quickly and said there will not be a joint press event. And took us a few minutes to figure out, you know, we argued with him and then took a few minutes to figure out why, because he understood that he was not Jiang Zemin. And the joint press event was going to be with Jiang Zemin, and that we in Washington might see Zhu Rongji as it were, the co-equal premier head of government in most systems and the man who was doing the WTO negotiation. Zhu Rongji understood perfectly well that, you know, well, he could kick around party secretaries all over the country. He was not going to try to compete with Jiang Zemin on the world stage for at a press conference. Anyway. Like to open it up for comments. So if people could wait for microphones, identify themselves, identify their institution, and ask a question. And although we know there's a lot of wisdom out here, preferably don't make a speech. Let's gentlemen in the front here.
Hi.
Direct your question at someone if you wish, unless you want to direct to the whole panel.
Hi, Chen Weihua, China Daily. Thank you for sharing the interesting anecdotes about Zhu Rongji. And, you know, as a journalist covering Zhu Rongji's day one in Shanghai, when Jiang was the party secretary, you know, I'm a great admirer of my mayor and later premier. Obviously, I agree totally what you said. But since Chen Li said this is going to be academic and analytical, so I just thought it's probably more meaningful, interesting to just also delve into what lessons learned we could learn from Zhu Rongji's era. You know, in my mind, I mean, we discussed earlier like issues like social injustice. I mean, Nick talked about SOE reforms. I remember covering, I mean, million workers being laid off in Shanghai. It was not properly compensated. I mean, compared today, I mean, obviously. So that was a bitter story, a lot of them. And also the displacing of households, I mean, very little compensation as well. So I have a cousin living in Xintiandi, for example, being driven to Pudong, obviously. And also the environmental sort of concern people talked about in the early 90s has not been, I don't know, Dr. Lin has some insight, you know, was there a sort of a healthy debate at the time about this issue, social injustice, compensation for, you know, SOE workers and also the environmental implications. Thank you.
Anyone, Justin or others?
Well, let me, if you read the book, the discussion about compensation for laid off SOE workers is very detailed. Zhu knew exactly how much they were getting. They were supposed to be getting an amount that would cover kind of basic subsistence. And my memory is that came down to something like one quarter of their previous salaries, or maybe it was one third, something like that. So. There's a detailed discussion about how this was going to be financed, how enterprises had some responsibility, local governments had some responsibility, the central government had some responsibility, but that this was flexible, that if the enterprise couldn't cover it, then they'd have to make special arrangements. So I don't think there was any illusion that people that got laid off were going to be able to maintain their previous existing levels of income if they didn't find another job, and there were the reemployment centers. And I think the overall experience was actually, as I said earlier, fairly favorable. Most people did get jobs, and obviously a lot of them probably suffered some loss of income in the transition. But there was a very basic, maybe primitive, but basic social safety net for people that lost jobs. On the broader question of, you know, the lessons of Zhu Rongji, I would say that, you know, we need to look also a little bit at the next 10 years of the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao period, when economic reform basically stalled. State-owned enterprises, which had a huge boost of productivity for a few years, fell back into their old money-losing ways. and their productivity declined, and you know, from around the middle of the 2000s onward, state-owned enterprises have become an increasing drag on economic growth because the kinds of reforms that you launched, I don't think were sufficiently sustained in the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao period. So I certainly think one of the lessons is, somebody said once to me that a year or two into the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao period, Zhu Rongji said to an associate, in 2 years they've undone everything that I accomplished in 10 years. I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but there was certainly a loss of momentum, and Justin gave it a very nice interpretation. Well, the situation's different now, so, but one of the reasons the situation is different is that the reform momentum, I think, really significantly slowed in the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao period. So I certainly think one of the lessons is that even if you can launch a successful reform that makes some very substantial progress on dealing with some of the underlying structural problems, if you don't continue to move ahead, you inevitably retrogress.
Regarding the environmental issues, the internal policy discussion certainly paid attention to that. But the result was not as successful or as expected. I think there may be two reasons. One related to the stage of development in China. Because at this stage of China's development, manufacturing is still the key. And we know that manufacturing sectors, they have the characteristic of energy intensive and emission intensive. And at this stage of development, any country, the environmental issue will be more serious than when you are in the early agricultural stage or in the later in the service stage. So I think that the fluctuation related to the environmental issue in China, to some extent may not be so much related to the policy, the policy issue, because it's a stage of development issue. Certainly, China can do better if the implementation of the environmental code and so on will be honored by the local government. But as you know, that in the competition of local development, local officials, sometimes they do not pay so much attention to the environmental regulation and so on. I think the issue is the stage of development and the implementation at the local level instead of in the top level, they don't pay attention to the environmental issue.
I think those are very important points and are accurate. One of the fundamental problems on the environmental issue is that they never created incentives for local officials that would lead them to prioritize environmental cleanup. And rather the incentives were to expand construction, to do big projects, to build infrastructure, to grow the GDP, and which would lay the basis for high evaluations and moving ahead. Also, the system itself makes local officials really care enormously about what happens within their own jurisdiction,
right,
but not what happens in any other jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is most environmental issues don't define themselves by jurisdiction. And so whether it's water pollution or air pollution or soil pollution or whatever, you just have huge problems when you have local officials both have an enormous amount of impact on what happens within their locality and are not incentivized to prioritize environment and are not incentivized to care about what happens downstream or downwind from where they are.
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah. Sorry?
Identify yourself. Yourself.
Oh, Wendy Dobson. Come back to the issue of corruption and put it perhaps in a forward-looking context because it is so important right now. A knee-jerk Western response to the problem of corruption would be, well, you need the rule of law, you need an independent judiciary, and you need a free press to shine light on corruption and create, so changing institutions to create incentives that we've just been talking about. that may be lacking. I'd like to hear everybody's assessment of how Jurongji went about it and whether it creates any precedents for how it's being treated now, because one of the concerns is that everybody's changing their behavior, but temporarily, until this blows over. That's basically the question, I guess.
Volunteers?
Well, I think that let me respond this way. You know, I'm a student of Gary Baker's, and we know that the way to deal with the corruption issue, on the one hand, you need to increase the discipline and the punishment. And on the other hand, you need to reduce the gain of corruption and the rent or rent-seeking. I think that, as I mentioned, due to the state of development in China at that time, the protection and subsidies to the state-owned sectors was a necessity to maintain the stabilities. And there are some side effects of those kind of subsidy and protection to the state-owned sectors because it created distortion and rent and rent-seeking. And that was one of the roots of corruption. And under that kind of context, the emphasis certainly is on the discipline. So Premier Zhu was very firm on anti-corruption campaign. But because the rent was so large, as long as you reduce your discipline and so on, the corruption will become a big issue. But I think that now the situation is better in the sense that, on the one hand, certainly we need to strengthen the anti-corruption campaign, discipline and punishment. On the other hand, if you follow the third planner to further reform, to remove all those kind of distortion, then the gain from the corruption will be much smaller. So I think there's two ways, not only the way you just mentioned, but also it's very important in a transition economy to reduce the rent and then buy the further market-oriented reform.
No one else wants to dive in? I mean, it's a great question and highly relevant today. But,
before anyone asks, I'd like to point to one of the very important legacy of Zhurongji in China and also in the world was his use of infrastructure investment as a main counter-cyclical measure under the shock, you know, of the economy. Because in 1998, due to East Asian financial crisis, the economic growth rate in China slowed down significantly. And at that time, he used infrastructure investment financed by fiscal expansion as a counter-cyclical measure. So if you look, at the beginning of 1998, the highway system in China only have 4,700 kilometers. And supported by the fiscal expansion and infrastructure projects, by the time of 2002, 1 year before he stepped down as a prime minister, the highway system in China increased 5 times to 25,000 and 100 kilometers. And I think that this is a very effective, you know, intervention measure. Because during the downturn, to use infrastructure investment on the short run created demand and jobs, stabilized the economy. And in the long run, the productivity in China was enhanced. And the bottleneck of growth in China was released. And I can give one figures to support this argument. And before 1998, whenever China had 2-digit growth rate, China also had 2-digit inflation rate. But after 2002, with the expansion in the infrastructure removing of the bottleneck, China experienced 6 years of 2-digit growth rate, but inflation rate was less than 4%. And that's one of the major contributions of his infrastructure as a counter-cyclical measure that, you know, to cope with the challenges. And in 2008, when China encountered the global financial crisis, China used that, you know, method again. And I'm very delighted to say now IMF also recommends similar measures to other countries if they encounter the shocks and a slowdown in their economy, and they say infrastructure investment is the best way to cope with this kind of, you know, need for expansion of the fiscal policies. I think that's one of the important legacies in China, but also to the world.
Ken?
I'll add just one or two points. I agree with everything you said, including the lesson for other countries.
Yeah.
There is a long history in China of very, very tough campaigns against corruption. And they have a limited effectiveness over time. You know, everyone scrambles and cuts back their you know, liabilities, if you will, in their corrupt activities for a while. But then the campaign has to ease off because you have other priorities and you need to get people to take more initiative and so forth. And then corruption begins to grow again. And after a while, it becomes important enough that it moves to the center of the stage again. I think to really get at that, therefore, you need, among other things, to reduce the extent to which the state intervenes in the economy at a micro level, at the enterprise level. And that's not only state-owned enterprises versus private enterprises, but the control of all kinds of things that make or break business opportunities. I think those things remain very pervasive. So I think it's a huge job to reduce those. You also need a very, very good regulatory system. You need to have good regulations, and you need to have regulators who really understand what they're talking about, have the ability to get the information they need, and then have a legal system that they can go to, or a system of sanctions they can go to, to give what they do teeth. And that, again, is not easy. So there's no such thing as, you know, getting rid of corruption. But corruption in China in the last decade or so has become truly predatory. And so there's an enormous need to whittle that down. You see some of the approaches that one would want to see to get there. But I think that it is well short of what may be required eventually to really get this problem under substantial control.
In the back.
Thank you very much. My name is Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. I believe Zhu Rongji was leading the China's efforts to embrace globalization and integrate into the international system. But in a different context of China's development, do you think the new Chinese leaders still have the inclination to integrate into the international order, which is dominated by the United States? Thank you.
Let me just comment on the Zhu Rongji part of that, and I'll leave it to Justin and Nick. The Zhu Rongji part, one of the things that comes across very clearly in these papers, et cetera, was that Zhu was not, to my mind, a globalist. He was not a liberal internationalist. He talked about foreign investment in China, about joining the WTO, et cetera, very much in terms of these are the specific things we need to get out of this for China. We need technology. We need more modern management. We need to open up foreign markets so that we can grow our exports. We need to, as necessary, to control the exchange rate in order to give us opportunity. And if we can't control the exchange rate, then we have to use things like, you know, rebates on export taxes and that kind of thing in order to remain competitive, because we need all that in order to realize our own economic goals. So he was not, to my mind, someone who believed in globalization in terms of broad trade theory, you know, that reducing barriers to to trade if you play out the comparative advantage analysis, leaves everyone a winner with greater special interest. This is what we need for China. We need to keep this under control, and we need to use it effectively because it's one of the keys to enabling China to reach its own aspirations.
Well, first, the current government certainly is continuing to embrace the globalization. And if you read the third planner, you can see that China needs to use two resources, domestic resources and foreign resources. China needs to rely on two markets, domestic markets and the global markets. So I think the direction is very clear. We'll continue to push towards that direction. But Ken is also right, because China is a transition economy. In transition economy, you have a lot of legacies in the past. It does not mean that you remove all the barriers, then it's going to be a win-win for both sides. So we need to have some kind of program to pace this kind of speed of globalization. And I think that you can say that is for national interest, but I think it's also for the global interest. Because if there's a chaos in China, certainly it's not good for China, but it also it's also not good for the world. Yeah. But overall, I think that the direction of globalization, direction of the openness will continue. And how far we can go certainly depends on the domestic strength as well as the global situation.
Let me just say briefly, I agree with Justin. I think all the evidence is that this Xi Jinping, Li Keqiang leadership is very committed to continuing opening up. It's certainly reflected in the third plenum document where over and over again they talk about the need for increased competition, a level playing field, which also implies that you're going to reduce barriers to trade and investment and so forth. And then you look at the practical side, the range of things that China's currently negotiating, finished a free trade agreement with Australia, which is fairly far-reaching a few months ago, negotiations on the bilateral investment treaty, a much better offer in China's efforts to become a signatory to the government procurement agreement. Now, at every step, foreigners are saying, well, this is an improvement, but it's not good enough. But the trajectory, the direction, I think, is positive. The offers that are coming in many of the negotiating domains are quote-unquote, what we would consider to be better, more liberalization. So I don't think there's much doubt that they're committed directionally, but I think, as Justin said, the pace will depend on the domestic economy and the political constraints that the leadership faces.
I would just say one thing, just picking up on what Ken said about Zhu's approach in 2001. The challenge was very different than now, and where China was then is very different from now. No one was thinking about China as a major foundation of the global economy in 2001. No one was talking about China's responsibility for global prosperity in 2001. People were talking about China's growth, and that was going to be its contribution. I think that began to change with Bob Zelig's speech about responsible stakeholdership in 2005, 2006, where the notion was that China had to become a responsible foundation of the international system. And now if you look at what China's doing, clearly the current leadership understands that, that they understand that they have a different challenge. It's not just development of China, but that their integration into the global economy is not merely a benefit to China, but that they have a responsibility more broadly, and a lot of what they're doing, I think, reflects that. So it's just a very different stage in history, I think. David, did you?
I'm signaling one more question.
Oh, you were signaling one. It wasn't you.
Not permitted that.
I'm disappointed. okay. The gentleman on the right out there.
Thank you for the discussion. I have a question for Mr. Bader. You mentioned that the relationship between Premier Zhu Rongji and Jiang was complicated. I'm wondering what's the relationship between the current premier, Li Keqiang, and Xi Jinping. It's still complicated. Well, she tell him, don't go there.
That's a wonderful question, which I hope the next panel will get into. And I am a mere lowly moderator. I've said more than I should have. So it's a great question. I hope it will come up, will be answered sometime during the day, but not by me. I regret. Maybe there's time for, we have about a minute or two. Gentlemen in the back. Last question.
Thank you very much. David Parker from CSIS. Obviously, from your comments and from China's experience under his leadership, Zhu Rongji was an extraordinary leader, but he was also one man. So what do you think some of the institutions and processes that he established that were really critical to the success of such a broad-ranging and ambitious reform drive?
Well, I'm not quite sure I heard or understood the full question, but in terms of legacy, he was one man, but the institutional changes that he instituted have had an enduring effect. I mean, he moved, for example, to reorganize the central bank so that it had regional offices where, in effect, the central bank was given a great deal more independence vis-a-vis, first-party secretaries in various provinces and cities. So that was a major institutional change, and it's discussed in very clear terms in the book. I think we knew about it at the time, but this is the first I've seen him the actual statements about that. Justin mentioned the asset management companies, which had a key role in the restructuring of the banking system in the early part of the 2000s. Some of them still exist and are still playing a role. So I think he instituted a lot of institutional reforms that, he was one man. We're putting him front and center in this discussion, but there were major, major structural changes that he instituted that have had an enduring effect.
Thank you all very much. Thank you for some excellent questions and for helping stimulate our terrific panelists into a great discussion. Could you please acknowledge our panelists and take a break before we make the
this next second panel. There'll be a break later, so if you want to talk to them individually, please wait for the break. I need Qin Xiao, Huang Yiping, and Arthur Krober to come up here. I like the way that Bader described this panel as moving from the past to the present. So if we get our three participants up here, if we get them mic'd up and clean water glasses, then we can move ahead. So in the interest of efficiency, I'll just make a few introductory remarks from here so we can move into the second panel while our participants are being mic'd up. Qin Xiao. Yeah. All right. So I'm David Dollar. I'm a senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center here. Our second panel is entitled Third Plenum Reforms, Opportunities and Challenges. I found the first panel really fascinating, looking at that history, and I think it was Nick Lardy who suggested that following Zhu Rongji, there really was 10 years or so where there was not a lot of reform momentum in China. But then new leadership came to power, put out a very impressive set of reforms at the third plenum a little bit more than a year ago. We've got a fantastic panel to discuss these contemporary issues. We've got three analysts based in China. I'm going to start with Qin Xiao, who's the council chairman of the Boyuan Foundation, long history in the financial sector in China. And then I'm going to turn to Huang Yiping, who's a professor of economics at the National School of Development at Peking University. And then to Arthur Krober. Arthur's a non-resident fellow of our Brookings Tsinghua Center at Tsinghua University. He's also the managing director of GavCal Dragonomics in Beijing. So I've asked each of them to start with no more than 8 minutes, discussing what they see as some or even just one of the key reforms in the third plenum. Why is it important and what's the progress? And then I'll ask them a few questions, and then we'll leave plenty of time to turn to the audience. So I'm going to start with Qin Xiao.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Before we're talking about the implementation, we spend a couple of minutes to talking about the significance and the importance of this package or agenda, reform agenda passed in the third plenary. Number one, I think it's the whole package, the total solution, not piece by piece. So it consists of about over 300 projects and address almost all the outstanding issues in China and have a timetable, have a target. So it's we haven't seen such kind of comprehensive and with clear directions, a total package reform as we expected. So, and plus there are strong organizations being set up to guide to carry out this this program. It's headed by Xi Jinping, and there are some procedures, and I will invite some independent evaluators, companies or organizations to evaluate. And there are, if you have interest, I'll explain the procedures to how to carry out that. Among them, I think there are a few topics for reform are so critical and important. It does not mean that 300 equally distributed resources. We need to focus our resources on some certain more important project or areas. Number one is the fiscal reform. Number two is the financial one. Number three is the price of by factor market. Number four is the SOE. And I think remaining could be is also important, but could be classified as a second priority for them. It seems to be the last year, no significant actions or plans for reform happened. But if you look carefully, actually it's still going forward. I understand the number one, it's quite comprehensive. They have timetable, they have target, but need to have a roadmap, need to have some detailed plan, need to coordinate between the state council and the central committee, and need to consult some expert, and they understand among these hundreds of projects, there are some interactions. Some of them are reinforced. Some are, you must pay some costs for reach the others. So they did something. For instance, the budget law is almost yet to be delivered after four round discussions, which will have more discipline, more transparency, and will cut down significantly the fee charge. In China, the total revenue, including the tax and the fees and some others, like land, the fees takes a big portion, and there's no discipline. Even in the county level, they can charge fees. So that's a big progress for budget law. And also you will see the significant reduce or remove the administrative approval for setting up business activities, which reduce significantly the transition cost for running business. That's being well received by the market. And they have some structural reduction of the tax to give more fair conditions for SMEs and private sectors. In the financial industry, you'll see the progress for the interest rate liberalization and exchange rate liberalization and opening up under the capital account. So it has been done for several years, and I will say that it's the last mile. So it's almost close to equilibrium point, both the interest rate and the exchange rate. It's still try to go, maybe it takes 2 years or less than 3 years. I personally believe within a couple of years they can reach the target to finalize the last mile. And the factor market is also a project being, it's an ongoing project being pushed forward for several years. They have formula in terms of the energy. I mean the oil and also the land, particularly industrial used land and the labor cost being liberalized. And some utility products, it still have a big have a gap, particularly for the tradable products like energy, they still have a gap. But I appreciate the approach to gradually try to merge this gap instead of because if you look at the oil price will jump 100% and down 100%. So, and some there are some reforms I will not mention one by one. I think next year, this year will be a quite important year to see the implementation, and we would like to know the implementation plan. Rather than just a target and timetable. We would like to see some significant progress being achieved. So I think this year is quite critical, a very important year. So let me stop here.
Okay, excellent. Excellent on time and excellent on substance. Let's turn to Huang Yiping.
Thank you. What I like to do is probably to supplement what Chairman Qing Xiao said about the economic reforms, but I want to take one step back to look at why we need this new big reform program now after 36 years of significant progress at a more macro level. Economic reform last 3 decades or more now is basically a transition from the central planning system to the market system. And the approach, as Justin mentioned earlier, is typically described as a dual-track approach. So essentially, you have one part of the economy continuously to be supported by government policies or controlled by government policies, but the other part of the economy is being liberalized. That's the essence of the reform approach. And overall, it's been working well, as you probably have seen. But my own sense is there were actually two dual-track approaches during the last 3 or 4 decades. The first approach, which is very popularly identified, and Justin mentioned earlier, is the dual-track approach between the state sector and the non-state sector. When you liberalize, you keep all the state-owned companies, but hopefully the non-state sector will rise much more rapidly. And then after a while, hopefully the non-state sector becomes dominant in the economy and the transition to a market economy will be very smooth. However, there is actually a second dual-track approach, which is not that widely discussed, but that's actually my academic research interest, is the dual-track approach between product market and factor market. You look at the product market today in China, agricultural market, manufacturing market, and the service market, they've all been almost completely liberalized, and the prices are freely determined by demand and supply. But if you look at the other part of the economy, the factor markets, for markets for labor, for capital, for land, for energy, for water, I think you understand this, the distortions and the controls in this area are still very massive. So you look at the Chinese economy today, we have still been on the way to a market system, But almost everything is halfway slow. And that's why I think we need the bigger program to complete the transition. The first transition, actually, the first dual track approach actually was successful. And as we know, that helped China to maintain very strong growth, but it also caused some problems. So for instance, we're talking about what the Premier Zhu Rongji did in the 1990s, and he had very ambitious reform programs. But if you look at the 1990s, what happened in the economy at the time? Apart from the very positive side of economic booming, we actually had almost three major economic crises in the 1990s. The first is a fiscal crisis, when the government revenue as a share of GDP dropped from 36% at the beginning of the reform to almost 10% at the beginning of the 1990s. So it was a big challenge. The second almost crisis that we had was the banking crisis. In 1998, the non-performing loans were estimated at between 30 to 40%, the ratio, you can imagine. Any economy with a non-performing ratio that high would experience a banking crisis, but we didn't because the government in the end supported it. And the third almost crisis was actually in the state sector alone. The state sector around the mid-1990s had a net loss-making record. The rough saying at the moment was one-third made explicit losses, one-third made implicit losses, and one-third was roughly even. So the sector as a whole was making losses. I think the problems we experienced in the fiscal system and in the banking system actually were closely linked to the loss-making in the state sector. And that's why, in part, we needed Zhu Rongji in Beijing and to oversee all these reforms. The fiscal reform, as you probably already know, the fiscal revenue as a share of GDP now is up to around 22%. The banking sector reform, Justin mentioned earlier on, all sorts of measures, step, writing off non-performing loans, recapitalize the banks, introducing foreign strategic investors and public listing. The biggest change, as Nick also mentioned earlier on, is a reform of the state sectors, the so-called let-go small-medium enterprises and focusing on the larger ones. So we never use the term privatization, but literally 500,000 of the SOEs were gone within a very short period. And that actually laid the foundation of a very strong growth early on. So I thought that actually was demonstrate what kind of problems we caused with the first dual-track approach. And that laid the foundation of a very strong growth in the following 10 years, obviously helped with the WTO accession. But I think you would agree the SOE problem has not been fixed completely. That's why the third plenum a year ago was still talking about SOE reform as a key priority. The second dual track approach, as I mentioned, is basically about the factor market distortion. And I think Justin mentioned earlier, some of the distortions were really necessary to facilitate and support the first dual track approach, because you want to support SOEs, you need some kind of resource allocation, pricing, and so on to support continuation of the sector. But the one way of summarizing the distortions in the factor market, in my view, is just pushing down the cost of inputs. So the cost of capital, as a good example, in the formal sector is much lower. But that actually happened not only for capital, but also for energy, for land, and many other factors as well. So the one way of generalizing the second dual-track approach or distortions in the factor market is the kind of implicit subsidies we've been providing to the corporate sector, but the taxes on the households. You can make more elaborate cases. But the essence is it's a redistribution of income from household to the corporate sector. That's why growth is very strong, exports strong, investment is strong, production is strong, but the consumption as a share of GDP has been declining, simply because household income was not growing as rapid as GDP growth. So we end up with today's growth model, once Wen Jiabao described, as uncoordinated, inefficient, unbalanced, and unsustainable. But really, you look at it, it has two sides. On the one hand, growth is very strong. But on the other hand, the structural problems are growing rapidly, which make it unsustainable. So I think what we really need to face now is not so much about the growth story today, but how to rebalance the economy and make the growth more sustainable. My own subscription and my reading of the third plenum decision is to liberalize the factor market. And that, I think, is what we need to do. This is why they all mentioned about the financial liberalization, the resource pricing, and maybe also a little bit more about the labor market reform. But for these reforms to be smooth and successful, you need, again, to transform the state sector. Simply because if the state sector's behavior doesn't change, don't even think about a market-based interest rate or exchange rate. So I think these two actually are closely linked, and the simplest way to look at, in my view, is just to complete what Deng Xiaoping started and what Zhu Rongji made a significant progress, but the job is not yet done.
Thank you very much, Yiping. Arthur?
Thank you. Sorry. Is this all right? I'll just make four points very quickly to supplement what Chairman Jin and Professor Huang have said to present a slightly different angle. The first comment I would make on the Xi Jinping reform program is I think it's important to understand that it is not simply a technical economic reform program. I think often it's viewed too narrowly. It's actually a much more ambitious effort to restructure the entire governance system of China. And I think this is an important thing to understand, both to understand how all of the bits of the program link together and also some of the sequencing. And I think the observation was made that when you talk about all of these different economic problems that you see in China, ultimately they go back to problems of governance. And sometimes this is discussed in terms of incentives of local officials or whatever, but the governance structures lie at the root of many of the economic problems. And so I think quite appropriately, the emphasis of the third plenum reform program is really on tackling the governance issues. And you can see this, for example, in the fact that one of the major programs that has actually gotten started is the fiscal reform program. And this is actually, I think, taken priority over some of the more financial-oriented reform programs. And again, I think that's appropriate because fiscal relationships lie at the root of many of the problems. So that's the first point. I think that you have to think of this as a governance reform project, not simply as a technical economic reform project. The second point, which flows from that, is that I think there are, when we assess how well the reform program is going, I think there's a tendency to overlook two elements which don't seem like reforms in a sense, but actually I think lay the groundwork for other reforms. The most important is the anti-corruption campaign, which has been much stronger, broader, and more long-lasting than anyone anticipated. And I think my interpretation of this is that the anti-corruption campaign has several goals, but one of them, which I think is not focused on sufficiently, is the idea that there needs to be a complete reset of the expectations of what is the tolerable level of corruption at throughout the government. Because I think the previous panel sort of brought forth the point that corruption is kind of endemic in China. It's to some extent a natural concomitant of a very rapid capital-intensive growth process. You can't eliminate it. But there has been not enough systemic efforts to restrain the incentives for corrupt behavior. And I think one of the efforts now is to essentially do a reset and lower the bar for what is an acceptable a level of corruption or corruption that will trigger some kind of action. Related to that is, I think, one of the great achievements of the current government is to ratchet down the expectations for GDP growth and take some of the emphasis off of GDP growth as the sole indicator of success. And Xi Jinping has been very vocal through most of the last several months in getting forward this idea of a new normal of economic growth, by which he means a much lower number. I think most analysts are anticipating that the final GDP number for 2014 will come in lower than the target rate. The target was 7.5 for the year, and it probably will come in around 7.2 or 7.3. This would be the first miss in quite a long time. And I think resetting the expectation about growth at a lower level and also tolerating growth that comes in below a government target is an important step in moving away from GDP targeting, which is, in fact, one of the sources of corruption, rent-seeking behavior, and bad governance at the local level, because local authorities have had an incentive to focus only on headline GDP growth, almost to the exclusion of everything else. So the anti-corruption campaign and resetting the growth expectations, I think, are two important components of the overall program, and they kind of set the or clear the field for some of the more specific reform measures. And so the third observation I'd like to make is just if we go down the list, I think there's been a tendency among many outside observers in the course of the last year, particularly in the financial community, which is what I interact with most of the time, to say, well, yes, they had this great plan at the third plenum, but that was over a year ago, and what have they done since? Really, nothing has been delivered. And I actually think this is just not true. If you look at what we've had in the course of the last year, we've had the following. We've had a Politburo-approved fiscal reform program which will redesign the tax system and the local government finance system within 2 years, and that's really critical. We've had a first step towards a liberalization of the hukou policy, which is a very important move for freeing up labor mobility and dealing with some of the factor price distortions that that Yiping talked about. We've had an abolition of registered capital and administrative registration requirements for new businesses, which is very important because, again, it removes the gatekeeper role of many local agencies, it removes an avenue of corruption, and it opens up, it makes it much easier to set up a new private business. So if you're trying to reallocate resources into the private sector, lowering the barriers of entry to private companies is hugely important. It's already had a huge impact. We had an over 40% increase in new company registrations this year, despite the fact that economic growth was slowing. So it shows that there was a response to a real pent-up demand for new business activities. We've had a further liberalization of deposit interest rates in terms of allowing a wider band in which banks can exceed the benchmark rates given by the PBOC. We've also had the publication of draft rules for deposit insurance, which once the deposit insurance scheme takes effect, that sets the stage for full liberalization of interest rates. Finally, I think I've left out a couple of things, but the final thing is that we've had a material change in the opening of the capital account through the linkage of the Hong Kong and Shanghai stock markets. And I think the important thing is, first of all, this is a very impressive list. And if you go around the list of other major economies in the world, I don't think that you can find a single one that in 1 year has been able to accomplish so much in terms of really basic economic reforms. But many of these things have been talked about and discussed for years and years and years and sort of were never able to get off the ground. And the fact that they've all moved forward this year, I think, is a strong endorsement of the government's ability to get things done. So the final point, just very briefly, though, is, as you can tell, I think my overall view on the trajectory now is relatively optimistic. But I think the scale of the challenges is enormous, and I'd just like to finish by sharing a little bit of puzzlement, actually, that I have on state sector reform, which I agree with Nick and Yiping and several of the other panelists is a really critical part of the agenda. And one of the things that I find mystifying in when you compare the current situation with the situation that Zhu Rongji dealt with 15 years ago is there was a big problem with state-owned enterprises. They were a major drag in the economy. And the response to this was a massive program which resulted in the closure or privatization of more than half of these enterprises and the loss of somewhere between 30 and 40 million jobs in the state sector of between 1995 and 2005, which, just to put that in perspective, most of these workers were in industry. The maximum employment that has ever existed in the entire U.S. manufacturing sector was 19 million in 1979. So in the course of 10 years, China laid off from its industrial sector about two times as many people as have ever worked in one time in manufacturing in the United States. This was a gigantic and massive social dislocation, and it was done with surprisingly little unrest. It was an extraordinarily ambitious but also very relatively smoothly carried out program. When you look at the problems of the state sector today, they are relative to the size of the economy much smaller. The state sector has shrunk. Its employment is a much smaller share of the total. And probably to fix many of the problems in the state sector, you would need to create job losses, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 million, which is a big number, but it's a lot smaller than we had before. And I'm a little bit perplexed as to why the government has been so reluctant to be more aggressive on state sector reform when the benefits are very clear in terms of improved resource allocation. And the costs compared to the state sector reform that was done 15 years ago would be far, far less because you would have to close a much smaller number of enterprises, lay off a much smaller number of workers, and you're doing it at a time where the labor force as a whole is beginning to shrink. So the prospects for laid off workers on the job market are much better than they would have been 10 or 15 years ago. So I have, to conclude, a generally positive view of the trajectory of the reform process now. But I have a little bit of concern about the reluctance, the apparent reluctance to tackle the state-owned enterprise sector component of it. And I do feel that because that represents one of the major locuses of vested interests and obstructions of market-oriented reforms, I think we're going to need to see something much, much more aggressive in terms of state-owned enterprise reform if the total reform package is to achieve its goals.
Okay, thank you very much. So what I'd like to do is start the discussion with a question for each of you, you know, which others can feel free to weigh in on if they're interested. What I'd like to do is start with Qin Xiao. Within a few days, we'll get the GDP data, you know, the final data for 2014. The market expects that the 2014 growth rate is a little bit below the target, you know, probably about 7.3. There's a lot of speculation about 2015. Will the government set a lower target of around 7%? Or is the government not really able to accept that? And I think that the deeper part of my question is looking at 2015, you know, to what extent are we likely to see stimulus versus reform? There have been some reports in the press about NDRC approving, I believe it was 10 trillion yuan, a little bit more than a trillion U.S. dollars worth of investment projects. I can tell a story about why that's not a major stimulus, but certainly there's some speculation in the press about that there might be a major stimulus program. So you know, does the government really accept that growth is slowing down towards 7? What's your view?
I think the government's target in the short term to deal with the cyclical issues, or most of the cyclical issues, rather than the structural one, they want to stabilize their growth rate. Because the growth rate was consecutively declining since the second or third quarter of 2013. That's too quick. And they will change the expectations of the market. So they want to stabilize, but they do not want to bail out. Very minor one, but do not want to bail out. But it seems to be gradually stabilized. And there are still some instrumentations or resources could be used physically and currently could be used. So number one, I think the next 2 years will gradually reduce and arriving something like 7 will stabilize for some time. That does not mean that for long run, for the short run or medium term. Number two, I don't think the government will have some big, ambitious bailout. Number three, I think that's good condition for the reform.
Okay, thank you very much. Yiping or Arthur, do you want to weigh in on that first question?
I just want to add that you said the 7.3% is slightly below the target. It actually is on the mark, because when Li Keqiang, Premier Li Keqiang said the growth target should be around 7.5%. According to some officials, the definition of around 7.5% is literally between 7.3 to 7.7.
Okay, good. So China hits its target. I always bet on China to hit its target.
What Li Keqiang said is a reasonable range.
Yeah. Yeah, which is sensible. Yiping, my question for you is, you know, you said that the SOE issue was not completely fixed, which I think, you know, I think there's broad agreement about. So could you say a little bit, and then you talked about the importance of freeing up the factor markets, which I agree with, which could indirectly affect SOE performance.
Right.
But is there a direct SOE reform plan, you know, in the third plenum or in follow-up? You know, what's the plan for SOEs? How is this issue going to be fixed?
Okay. I think the direction of SOE reform is very clear. I thought it was very clear when I read the document from the third plenum. The key direction is the management of the SOEs will shift from previously managing personnel, managing assets, and managing businesses, I forgot. But the key is in the future, the priority or the focus will be exclusively on management of the state-owned assets, which means the return to the state-owned assets will be the most important concern for the government. I thought if that happens, then it will be very good. A revolutionary change. And one way of putting it is, think about traditional SOEs. Everything is managed by the government. And the new model, it might not be very accurate, but think about the Temasek model in Singapore. You have a company which manages really, the purpose is to maximize returns on state-owned assets without necessarily always getting into the details of the management itself. So I thought it was very encouraging, very revolutionary. However, I share Arthur's confusion a little bit. I think since the plenum, there are lots of discussions and different experiments going on in different areas. It's not entirely clear what really the reforms mean. Now, there are a couple of things happening. One is the government is trying to identify different types of SOEs. Maybe they will be used different reform approaches, which I think is understandable. If a company is in a competitive industry, then, well, you should leave it to market. But there are companies in utilities and in strategic industries who will be using different approach, which I think is understandable. The second approach is so-called mixed ownership. That's something I don't quite understand, because I thought we already have mixed ownership for all these SOEs, which are listed companies as at the same time. But the idea, obviously, is to expand the stake of the private sector in these companies. The question to me is, Does this have a significant impact on the governance, corporate governance? If not, then it's not going to be very significant. So the last thing I think is a little bit disturbing, but we don't know yet what will be the outcome, is it sounds like SASAC still want to exercise some controls or at least the influences on major corporate decisions. And if that gets its way, then I'm a bit concerned how much further we can get. So I don't know, to be honest.
Okay. Arthur Chintiao, you want to weigh in on state enterprise?
Yiping said a lot, but I fully agree. I think it's become a political issue or ideological issue rather than simply economic reform. Because you're talking about the public ownership and private ownership, the first one is socialism. Second one is capitalism. Talking about the Communist Party should rely on the state-owned enterprise to build up to governance the society, but talking about the national security and national interest, a lot of now, those descriptions, those definitions, it's not really clear. It's not logical. So I think it may be the last one to reform because less consensus there, more complicated there. I think one thing I strongly believe, because as Yiping said, instead of state-owned enterprise, it is public resources, I mean the capital. The capital is liquidable, movable. If you put in the company, that's SOE. If you put a social net, it will be public goods. So it does not, if that's way, we shifting from SOE to public resources, then we are rationally to calculate where is more needed, where is more efficient. If we look at the fiscal condition now, it's sound. It's the debt, in terms of debt, in terms of revenue, it's okay, it's good. But in the long run, say 20 years or 30 years, you found, number one, there is a big shortage, big deficit for social net, for Medicare, for environmental issue. And number two, now is a window time. If you do late, the more costly. So if the one day, when they find that, we already, Boeing already had a report of its national balance sheet. Let them know. If they realize that they have to do that. I mean, to take the capital from the SOE to social net and those.
Okay. Arthur, my question for you, you're welcome to weigh in on SOEs, of course, but I'll tell you my
say on that. Yep.
You mentioned HUCO. I think you were the only one who mentioned HUCO, or you certainly said more about it. And you cited it as one of the areas, you know, where there's actually some progress in important institutional reform. So I'd like you to say a little bit more about your sense of what's happening with HUCO reform. But my worry, which I think you know, is that it's very hard to pursue HUCO reform in the flagship cities where right. productivity is actually very high. And in fact, the labor force is probably going to start declining in these flagship cities because of China's demographics. So the reform, as I understand it, seems to be welcoming people to move into third and fourth tier cities right. where I wonder if they're actually going to get jobs and you know, are they actually going to get the social services that they allegedly or in principle are entitled to. So just yeah. you know, a little bit more, since you're there on the ground, a little bit more sense of what's actually happening with HUCO reform.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the just to simplify it, basically what was done in the HUCO reform proposal was to loosen the restrictions on people getting urban HUCO in smaller cities, but at the same time, it was very, very clear that the relatively tight HUCO restrictions on the first and second tier cities would remain in place. So basically, you're now much more free to move to any city that you wouldn't want to move to, but any city that you would want to move to, you can't go to. So I kind of share your concern that what we have so far is maybe not quite enough, and maybe perhaps even indicative of a potentially misguided urbanization strategy that is unwilling to contemplate the creation of really large-scale hub cities, and instead is trying to forcibly create much less efficient smaller cities across the country. So I think that's a legitimate concern. For me, the very fact, though, that there has been a specific move to relax the HUCO requirements at all is a huge step, because this has been talked about for literally decades, and nothing had been done. And I place my hope frequently when I'm in China and frustrated with the progress of developments at the moment, I place my hope on sort of the forcing mechanisms that occur over time. So if you're right that cities like Shanghai and so forth are going to start seeing a shrinking workforce soon and literally will not have enough workers to meet their needs, I think this reform, even though it doesn't address that problem now, it opens the door and it makes it possible for these bigger cities, politically possible for them to relax their HUCO requirements in a way that would have been, I think, inconceivable 3 or 4 years ago when there was just this iron restriction on touching HUCO at all. So, in short, I agree that what we've got now doesn't really get us that much. But in terms of expanding the boundaries of what's politically possible for further reform down the road, I think it's quite significant.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. It may be that these initial experiments will, you know, will reveal that it's not too expensive fiscally to provide social services, and you can combine it with the central level fiscal reform. And then within a few years, you may have powerful demographic needs for more population, for more, you know, especially working age population.
Right.
And you could have a happy, you know, kind of happy coming together of successful experience in small cities with needs in big cities. Okay, at this point, let's turn to the audience and take questions about the current situation with reform. We've mostly focused on third plenum issues, but of course there's also been fourth plenum, you know, more recently taking up issues of rule of law, rule by law. So you know, any of the contemporary reform issues are open up, except though, let me just point out the next panel is really about international trade and investment. That's why no one has really said anything about the more explicit trade and investment issues. Let's leave those to the next panel. And so we get a microphone right here, please. And as usual, introduce yourself, please.
My name is Xiaofeng Sheng. I used to be a World Bank IFC person, and I'm now a visiting scholar with Peking University, the National School of Development, and also Johns Hopkins Science. I have one quick comment on the SOE and the institutional implications in SOE reform regarding the employment issues particularly. And I also have a question on the reform agenda, particularly the land market and the rural property reform for farmers. Okay, so the comment on SOE reform, I think it was extremely important to think about the unemployment impact, as Arthur pointed out. I really appreciate that. I myself didn't really understand the importance until 2003 when I worked in Sichuan with IFC projects. We looked at some very large SOEs. These are the largest among the large SOEs, military high-tech industries. And we realized a very dynamic company looked like a Changhong, had one-third of their employees that were absolutely redundant, shouldn't exist. And it existed only because of the institutional issues, because they belong to central government, the ministry management, and they couldn't be touched by the local government. But if you let those people go, the local government would jump because the burden will be on them. Okay, so it wasn't, at that time, it wasn't sought out issue. Who's taking the responsibility and how? Changhong management was very worried about this drag on their efficiency, their international competitiveness, but there was no solution at the time. We saw that a similar situation in a lot of the Northeast China cities as well. So now, on the coming reforms, I was just still wondering if the panelists could say a little bit more about the rural land property reforms, because it was talked for a long time in China. I think all the rationales, the importance was fully discussed and recognized in China, but it hasn't been done very much. And during and around, before and after the 18th plenary sessions, the advocacy was very strong in both mediums and the government documents even. But it seems like faded a little bit again. And I was wondering how is, how strong the central government is determined to address this issue. Because this relates to the local government fiscal problems. It relates to the hukou issue, and it relates to the urbanization issue. And basically, half of China's 1.3 billion population still in rural, and they don't have clear property rights as the other half who live in the city today. So,
good question. And you didn't mention that the issue is also very closely related to corruption in China, because a lot of the big-scale corruption deals with, you know, alienating land out of agriculture and developing it, and somehow money finds its way into someone's pocket. So who wants to take up rural land?
Just a very quick comment.
Okay.
It's politically incredibly sensitive. And I think the underlying concern remains that if you move too quickly to fully marketize rural land, that you wind up having a lot of abuses, and a lot of farmers will essentially wind up giving up their land at below market costs. And you know, I think there's some debate about how serious that concern really ought to be, but it is a serious concern. So my perception is that the high level of concern about the socially disruptive impact of an aggressive land marketization scheme has been a real obstacle.
Before answering questions about the land property rights, we should get clear what we mean by land. Okay. There are three kinds of land in the agriculture. First of all, agricultural land for the rice and the wheat, as it's called red lines. Nobody can change the use. Second is the housing of the farmers. The third one is the construction land for the countryside. In the very beginning was for the countryside, the smaller enterprise, but it no longer exists. Become part of the urbanization land. The agricultural land is no touch. It is a policy. But still some believe we do not need that such big of agricultural land. We can import. That's another story. So we're not talking about that. They have a contract to each farmers. They can transfer their contracts with others. Does not mean you really own that. You have rights of use for 50 years or a longer time, and during the time you can transfer your deeds or contracts. For the housing, the ruling they said is for your own to stay or to live, rather than go to market. If you want to change the ruling, you have to solve following issues. Number two, it being appreciated. The better off should be distributed between the owners and the government. That's the rule. because you change the unit. Secondly, there are big differences between those who live in a very close to big city and those who live quite remote to the city. So it creates big differences. So that's the majority of the scholars and the policymakers does not want to change this zoning quickly. We still see it as a problem. The third one is a construction. Now it's being acquired by government. It's not on the commercial price. It's some compensation. So that's the issue. Need to be reformed. Number one, you can identify this property of the collective property of the farmers. Number two, you can encourage them to participate in the development rather than just being sold by very low prices. That's
Can I just add on the point of the SOE reform and unemployment concern? Obviously, that's a concern for any government. But the point I want to make is compared to the time in the 1990s, the challenge is much less today. And look at the three indicators. Number one, you look at the total size of the state sector employment in the total labor force. It's much, much lower now. If you want a number, you could look at Nick's recent book. The second point is the labor market condition is very different. At the time when Zhu Rongji laid off so many redundant workers, our total labor force was rising by 8 million a year. There was a massive surplus labor in the countryside. Today, we already turned into a labor shortage problem, and labor force has been declining by 3 million a year. So it will be much easier to deal with the layoff worker issue. And finally, if you look at the social safety net, the social security system and so on, obviously it's not satisfactory, it's not good enough compared to what you see in other countries. But in 1998, there was nothing. There was almost zero for social protection. So I would say if Zhu Rongji could do it in the 1990s, we are in much, much better condition pushing ahead, but we need a Zhu Rongji.
Where'd the microphone go? Okay, up here, and then I'll go to the back, okay?
Thank you for that last sentence, because my question is for all of you, what influence do you think that Zhu's record, his focus, and his style has had on President Xi, if any?
Oh.
Jin Xiao, let's start with you. It's a great question.
He's so capable. As you can compare with Li Peng and Meng Jiabao, he's so capable. Whenever he made decision, he'll do that. The implementation ability is first class. And secondly, before making a decision, he's open and willing to listen. Sometimes he's even consult some expert abroad. That's second one. The third one, he knows, sometimes he knows he has to make political decision. It's not bureaucratic. It's not a technical one. For instance, WTO, if you rely on the expert, they will see thousands and thousands of problems. It's a political decision. So, like the, if you want to have the TPP with U.S. and other countries, you need American leaders have political decision. That's him. Well, what do we mean political decision? He knows the direction. He knows it's a window time. Miss this opportunity or miss again, miss ever forever. And he will know there's risks, and he will take the risks. That's.
Okay, let's go to the back. I don't like to discriminate against the back. There's a woman holding her hand up there. Yeah, her whole left hand, yeah.
I'm Jiang Yuquan with Xinhua News Agency, and I want to ask a question about hukou reform. And the hukou reform is still restricted labor to enter the big city, but it turned out that the job opportunity created in the big city are much larger than the small city. So how can the government or can to tackle this kind of dilemma? Thank you.
Arthur, you already made some intelligent comments. So can I ask Yiping or Qin Xiao, and then you can come back.
Yeah, I'm fine.
I'm actually not an expert, but I think that for any government, if you want to open up this reform, you have to have a starting point. The starting point is in the larger cities, we're already suffering from major pollution problems and traffic jams and all sorts of problems. So, yes, I agree. I think the larger cities should expand because of the greater opportunities there. But you need to fix many of the problems and ease the constraints so that you can actually do much better job. This is why, at the moment, I think the reform probably will start from relatively smaller cities. But I share your concern. I think we shouldn't go to too small size cities in the country because that will be detrimental, actually, to the skill efficiency. And even if you talk to people, migrant workers, where they want to settle, they actually normally don't want to go cities too small because that these areas with very limited, not only job opportunities, but also education opportunities for their kids. So I think we should, what the government is facing is to strike a balance between already overburdened infrastructure in the larger cities and the lack of interest in some of the smaller cities, and I think gradually the two have to converge over time.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this, or no? Okay, this woman here.
Hi, I'm Lynn Jones from U.S. International Trade Commission. I have a question regarding to the SOE reforms. The past SOE reform has seen a large decrease of the SOE numbers as well as the emergence of large SOEs through the consolidation. So my question is, what will characterize the approach and the objective of the current or future SOE reform? So it's going to be further improve the productivity and the profitability of the SOEs or reduce the size of the state sector and allow more competitions from private companies in those industries that SOE dominate or monopolize or the both? Can you elaborate a little bit? Thank you.
First of all, we should distinguish the SOE reform between the micro level and macro level. When we see enterprise level, corporate level, a lot of things could done, governance, productivity, innovation. But for the micro level, the state level, they should reform the institution. For instance, the mixed ownership, or they ask them to put the profit and losses in the budget and to debit to distribute their dividend and allocate certain their assets or stock in the social net. So that's two levels. I think I said. They already had produced some measures and ideas. It's on the way, but ultimately it takes some time to have a real reform. So I don't have high expectations for SOE's reform, but I do believe they will reduce the number. They will have a more mixed ownership.
Just a quick comment on the mixed ownership plan. I frankly find it very difficult to understand. So basically the idea is that provinces are being encouraged, and most of them I think have already published plans to introduce mixed ownership system to the majority of the state enterprises under their supervision. And at least at the outset, what this means is that outside non-state shareholders will be invited to take minority stakes in these province or county or municipal level SOEs. And the problem that presents itself is that a lot of these enterprises are in not very good financial condition. It's hard to understand why any outside investor would take a minority non-controlling stake in these not very good enterprises unless they got some promise of management control, which does not seem to be on offer. So, like, why would you do this? So this is one of the things that I'm – so it seems like either this is like some kind of compromise solution that no one really knows how it's going to work, or it is devised as kind of like the first stage to privatization, and it's politically necessary to use this term mixed ownership because politically you don't want to use the term privatization. But I think this is one of the very big question marks that I have right now, is that on the face of it, this program does not – it's not clear how it could possibly succeed at doing anything. So we'll just have to see how it works out.
Okay. How about one more question? This gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Steve Butler. Could you sketch out the sort of practical implications of going, you know, down to 7.3 and possibly 7%? Which sectors of the economy are hurt? How much do they have to worry about it? And to what extent is it really a constraint on further reform?
I hope everybody wants to weigh in on that, because I'm going to try to wrap up a couple moments before the program. The program says 10-minute break. I don't think 10-minute break is realistic, so I'm trying to buy a few minutes so we can have a slightly longer break and resume at 11:45. So,
and it's Yiping.
Okay.
Well, I think this actually is an interesting question. Looking at my own take is, you look at the Chinese economy, it's actually been slowing gradually. But if you talk to people on the ground, you find the feeling is actually much more painful than the headline numbers indicating. So from 8% to 7.5%, from 7.5% to 7.3%, these are like very limited changes, but the pain sounds like immense. I think there are at least two reasons why this is happening. You look at the Chinese economy last 30 years, 36 years. Economists like to say there are three engines of economy: export, investment, and consumption. And the economy is being mainly driven by, led by growth of investment and exports in the past, and most of them concentrate in the manufacturing industry. So we've been at the global manufacturing center for quite a while. But you look at these economies today, we are facing major difficulties in these areas. Number one, after the big stimulus package introduced in 2008, we are seeing rising overcapacity in the heavy industry, which used to support investment activities. And now the economy is slowing, investment is slowing. A good example is look at what happened in Australia. But the heavy industry, the steel, iron ore, aluminum, and the copper, cement, building materials, these are the areas where we suffer from major the overcapacity problem. Obviously, it will be difficult because they have been a backbone or a main driver of economic growth. So that's one part of the economy. The other part of the economy also is suffering from economic difficulties. The labor-intensive manufacturing industry, which has been the main driver of exports, again, a growth engine of the Chinese economy. The reason why the export sector is facing difficulties on one part because the global economy is recovering very slowly, but most importantly because we are entering into the high middle income range in the world, the so-called middle income trap. So at the beginning of the reform, our GDP per capita was $200, and whatever you can produce, it will be competitive in the market. But now it's $7,000. Whatever we've been doing successfully in the past, no longer competitive. And I think that this is the big challenge we are facing in the economy. So what I'm telling you is the economy has been very successful in the past and mainly driven by manufacturing expansion. But the two key successful story in the manufacturing industry now is facing huge difficulties. And this is why I think we're probably going to see further adjustment. Whether or not the economy can be successful, according to this so-called middle income trap, is whether or not we can rise. My overall assessment is I'm not that pessimistic, actually. I think we already start to see positive changes in the economy. So, for instance, you look at the consumption share of GDP, it's already adjusting. The service sector is already bigger than the manufacturing sector. That's why when the economy is slowing, employment is not a challenge so far. Most importantly, innovation is happening. You look at the online shopping, look at internet finance, you look at fast delivery, you look at these cheap mobile phones and manufacturing and so on. Actually, we're seeing lots of positive story, but when we are pessimistic, we tend to ignore all these stories. But I'm sure you heard about Alibaba. We just don't put them into the same picture as the macro story we're looking at. So a short, just a quick summary of my answer to your question is, I think many of the traditional areas we will continue to see difficulties. We need to deal with the overcapacity in the areas already exist. We need to upgrade the low-end manufacturing in order to survive. But I do think we actually are seeing industrial upgrading and innovation already. But obviously, we still need the big reform program to be implemented to sustain this process.
Arthur? Couple of just quick additional observations. One is if you look at the composition of the slowdown, it's clear where it's occurred. Between 2000 and 2012, the average annual real growth in capital spending was about 15% a year. That's now down to about 7 or 7.5%. So the growth rate in the investment side has already fallen in half. If you look at consumption, the average prior growth rate was around 8 to 8.5% in real terms, and that's down to about 7.5%. So it's also slowed, but substantially less, and that reflects the rebalancing that Yiping has indicated has already occurred away from the traditional heavy industry towards more consumer services. And I think that trend will continue. Just one quick note from the standpoint of analysts of this, it's a real problem because the data on the parts of the economy that are in trouble is very, very good. We have an excellent industrial survey. We have very comprehensive investment data that enable us to state with exact precision just how terrible things are in the traditional part of the economy. In the newer parts of the economy, such as the internet and all of these consumer services that Yiping referred to, the data is much worse. And the service sector generally, we have very, very poor data. So we have only a very fuzzy picture of how things are changing for, hopefully, the better in these new sectors. So we have a little, I think, and that's just to reinforce Yiping's point that I think right now we're at a point where there's a little bit of intrinsic bias in the analysis to focus on the negative because that's what we can see very clearly. And the positives we think are there, but it's a little bit harder to put our fingers on them.
Okay. I think we're going to bring this to an end. As I said, I wanted to buy a few minutes so we could have a nice tea break. The last session is going to be on U.S.-China trade and investment opportunities, which is a great topic, and my colleague Jeff Bader described that as the future. You know, so hopefully the future will be a much closer trade and investment integration between China and the U.S. So let's take a short break, and then we're going to start promptly at 11:45. Thank you. And let's give this group a nice round of applause. Yeah.